Well, hi everybody, and welcome to the Cultural Studies podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is
I'm Tim Taylor. I'm a professor in the Department of Ethnomusicology at UCLA, and where I'm also appointed in the Anthropology Department and the Musicology Department.
and you must be a busy beaver, Prof. Tim.
Yes, there's no end. As we all know, there's no end to admin, and ChatGPT is making us work harder too.
That's interesting. Perhaps we could talk about that in a moment, because of course it's very important in musical terms, as in all areas of cultural production. But to start off with, Prof, I'd like to ask you, and perhaps you've already hinted at a possible answer, about the things that are currently dynamizing, retarding, preoccupying, interesting you.
Well, intellectually, I think what I've been thinking about the most in the last few years really is how do we talk about capitalism as something that's total but not total? I mean, on the one hand, it seems to be everywhere, unless you go into like, the furthest, innermost reaches of the Amazon or something. But on the other hand, most of the musicians I know can't make a living at music. They can't get the capitalist music industry to pay them any attention. So how do we talk about capitalism as something that, as I say, seems to be everywhere, but that a lot of people can't get to recognize them? Most of the musicians I know are dying to commodify their music so just so they can make a living. I don't know anybody who talks about wanting to be a rock star. So I've turned my attention in recent work to just how this happens. I mean, if somebody like a Taylor Swift comes along, how did that happen when 10,000 people who want to be Taylor Swift couldn't make that happen? So I've gotten interested in people like music managers, historically people like Brian Epstein, whom I haven't written about, but so listeners know what I'm talking about. Brian Epstein, Colonel Tom Parker, and Elvis. And I did a small ethnographic project of some music managers here in Los Angeles, just to talk about how do they take a musician who might be starting to make some money, but how do they turn them into somebody who can make a lot of money, or at least make enough to live on? I found Anat Singh's work on scalability to be very useful. How do we talk about scaling something up? But you can't really scale up cultural production. I mean, a musician can only write so many songs, or a painter can only paint so many paintings. So how do you take what's essentially non-scalable and scale it? And Anat Singh has some interesting ways of talking about this. She's argued, for example, that factories in Western metropoles learned how to scale up through colonial plantations, making sure, as she puts it, project inputs were standardized so they could be scaled up. And this is a model that was taken, as I say, back to the metropoles, which I thought was a super interesting way to talk about that issue. So I have more to do on this. I think this was just one chapter in a book about this chapter about music managers. I think maybe in the future there'll be another project about producers. How do the producers imagine the sound of the musicians they work with to try to cultivate a broader audience? Producers have been studied to some extent, but I think not with respect to this particular question. So that's one thing. The other thing is, so I had a book come out last year called Working Musicians, which you kindly blurbed, Toby. And I'm working on this sort of prequel, to use local Hollywood language, because the current book starts in the 80s. So it's oral historical and ethnographic, but it's not very historical. And I thought at one point this would be two projects, starting in the post-war era, but it's really, sorry, I thought it would be one project starting in the post-war era, but it's turned into two. And the earlier part, which is going to concentrate on television, will start with the rise of television and into the 1980s, where there's a natural breaking point. I mean, there was a composers union that was busted in 1982. Electronic and digital technologies made a huge difference, starting in the 70s. So there's a kind of a natural breaking point. But what's got me interested in this project, because we have the CBS archive at UCLA, I spent a lot of time in it, and I've really gotten interested in the bureaucratic management of creativity. How does a big bureaucracy like CBS operate with respect to creative people like musicians, which is what I study. And one thing that has struck me is that there's a form for everything. There's so many forms that people had to fill out. It's just unbelievable. Of course, forms are like the output of bureaucracies, but it's really kind of astonishing, especially since time is managed down to the half second. So you had to be very careful about timing because advertisers, they own that last half second. So there's a lot of management just of time, but very little creative talk is contained in these forms or in any documents. I think all the creative language happened informally and was rarely written down, which is itself interesting. But anyway, I'm going on beyond what your question was, but those are the two main things I'm thinking about. The how do we conceptualize capitalism as being total but not total, and the bureaucratic management of creativity.
I think it's really great that in the latter case, you make it clear that bureaucracies aren't always public, that red tape isn't always public, that this isn't always about public service office holders sitting around in their offices. This is about private bureaucracy, which is infinitely greater and often more powerful in much of the world and in much of history, but is neglected in the nostrum that we are given again and again. Public sector must streamline itself and become more like the private sector. Horseshit. Sorry. Any of us who've worked in the corporate sector know that it's the most bureaucratic world imaginable. On to the first point, though, Prof. I think you've made a very valuable point that people are left out from capitalism again and again and again, but also that perhaps there is more than one capitalism. There are different kinds. There are small kinds, big kinds, self-destructive kinds, ecological kinds, and that there may even be musical kinds of capitalism on their own that need to be theorized and resisted and thought through. On that score, pardon the pun, it was unintentional. When it comes to working musicians, the ones that you know, and you're a working musician yourself, I should add, a very successful one, the working musicians you know, but also the ones you read about in the archives or in memoirs or whatever, what are some of the transformations that have come about in their lives in the United States or elsewhere over the last century? And I say that because it's now virtually a century since we've seen both the advent of radio and the advent of sound in cinema. And it's not that far off a century since we saw the spread of television. Three massive transformations in the working circumstances of US musicians.
Yeah, massive, and we're still grappling with them. I mean, what I tell my students, I teach a big undergraduate class, and it's hard for them to get their minds around it. But I simply say that, before the phonograph and the player piano, the only way to hear music was to hear it live or make it yourself. And what did it mean for these sound reproduction technologies to come into existence and start mediating music to you, so that music got categorized. Race records was African American music, and hillbilly music was rural white people's music. But the rise of the commodification of musical sound was a big deal, and it took really decades for people to get used to the idea. I mean, the player pianos and phonographs come in the late 1870s, early 1880s. It wasn't really till radio in the 20s that people finally got their head around with what was usually derisively called as mechanical music or canned music. Can't see me using my fingers for air quotes. And it took a lot of advertising. Some companies like the Victor Talking Machine Company were among the biggest advertisers in the country in the early part of the 20th century. And championing, classical music, especially like people like Enrico Caruso, the great Italian tenor, or musicians. A pianist could be having their ghostly fingers playing on your own piano keyboard through the mechanism of the player piano. But it took, decades and decades of a lot of advertising dollars to get people to think that buying musical sound is better than making it themselves. So it was really a wave of three technologies, sort of culminating with the radio, and aided too, I'm sure, by sound film starting in the late 20s. But, many decades. And
But
people
there's
still
still a
make.
yearning for of many people for live performance. Think of all the records that have been produced by rock musicians over the last 50, 60 years that are live, where frequently the singer can't sing very well, the instruments are off key, the sound is terrible, the audience makes noises at the wrong moments. People buy those records, if we can still call them records, and they go to those concerts. So despite this shift towards recording sounds, liveness still matters to a lot of people in music, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And even recordings. I mean, I read about this in one of my other books. Tactility. People, they want to hold that LP. Maybe
Yeah.
not so much, but there's something about, the size of the LP that if you buy a CD release of an older record with this tiny cover art, it looks terrible on the CD. But it looks great on the LP because that's what it was designed for. So it's been interesting to see the growth in the sales of LPs in recent years. And there was a boomlet in cassette sales. I don't know if it's still ongoing, but there was a period a few years ago when people were buying cassettes like crazy. So I think that still matters. And I think, yeah, as you say, yeah, I mean, people, especially post-pandemic, people really go to live shows. That still matters. For the sociality of it and to be able to see your favorite. I think it might have changed to some extent. So one of the music managers I interviewed, he talked about how, today's artists have to be on Instagram or TikTok, whatever, all the time. And he said, in the old days, by which he meant like the 80s and 90s, there was a mystery about performers and you get to see them once in a while and it was a really special event. And now he said, I can almost remember this verbatim. He said, you open Instagram and it's like, oh, there's my favorite musician's dog again, and he said that mystery is gone, and he thinks, it's not as special as an occasion as it used to be, which, may be true for some people. I don't know, but I think there is a risk of overexposure, I think.
And what of your musician friends and others you've interviewed who are not Taylor Swift talking about now in terms of survival and the ability to thrive as well as survive?
A lot of it is, things that we've heard about. It's about trying to figure out how much money you need to live the life you want to live, and then trying to figure out, if you can get, your one fan to go to one show a year and buy one T-shirt, then they spent $50. And if you can cultivate 5,000 fans like that, then you can make a living. So it's really thinking in sort of incremental terms, and it's. There's the luck of getting playlisted. People use that term as a verb now, playlisted on Spotify, or getting a track used in a TV show or film or a commercial. Then there's some serious money. But a lot of it is just cultivating not just a fan base, but a loyal fan base. So it's really becoming more like what the major software companies are doing. You don't, I mean, I remember in the old days, you would go to the computer store and you would buy Microsoft Word and it came in a box, and there was discs in the box and there was a manual and you bought it and you owned it. Now, of course, you subscribe. And I think that's the kind of model that some of these musicians are trying to cultivate too. You have that loyal fan base, which doesn't have to be huge, but it has to be loyal. But you need to figure out what you want, in order to live.
And merchandising, sales of things like t-shirts, as you mentioned, at concerts has become quite important because the days, I guess, of potentially big contracts coming from a major record company to relatively unknown bands seem to be gone. At the same time as there is more of an ability, and I guess this began with MySpace, to connect directly with potential fans without the artist and repertoire middle person. Yeah?
Yep. No, MySpace was big in back in the day. At the beginning of social media music, and that its successors still matter a lot.
And in terms of more popular social media of today, I'm thinking you mentioned Instagram, but also TikTok, pretty important.
TikTok, not so much Facebook. The younger folks are not looking at Facebook so much. And then, a lot of people use Spotify, so that's how they find new music. Radio still matters quite a bit. People think it's been, sort of eclipsed by Spotify, but radio still matters for the vast majority of listeners, except for like the most dedicated listeners who will go to Spotify. But it's kind of interesting that this ancient, this technology that's been in. Well, 1924 was the boom year for the beginning of radio, so now it's a century. So this technology that's been popular or getting popular for a century still matters.
Now, although we've spoken so far about the United States, Prof, your work is more expansive than that. In fact, I think your first book maybe is World Pop, if I got that right.
Global Pop, yeah, that was my first
Global
book.
Pop, sorry. Could you take us back, as they say in baseball commentary, and tell us about that book, but also what's changed in the quarter of a century, I guess, since it came out?
That book, it grew out of my dissertation, although most of it was not in my dissertation. Most of it was new, thankfully, for the readers. I got interested in cross-cultural musical appropriations, which were pretty common in the 80s, especially with Paul Simon's Graceland album, Ladysmith Black Mambazo. It's hard to call that an appropriation, but I got interested in these appropriations, collaborations, which seemed to be increasingly common. And it was only in the late 80s that the Anglo-American music industry invented the term world music. Or maybe I should say they popularized it. It had been in use. Ethnomusicologists were using the term, but it wasn't really a popular term. If you went to a record store before then, there would be an international section, and there wouldn't be much. There wouldn't be much in it, There might be, a few Nonesuch recordings of Balinese gamelan or, African drumming or something, or maybe like German polka music or something, but not much else. But so much European and American pop music was getting exported to the rest of the world that people were starting to make popular music that sounded to us like popular music. It just wasn't sung in English or a European language, except maybe a colonial language like French. So the industry invented this term or popularized this term world music in the late 80s. That helped sort of pave the way or create a kind of niche so that people could hear music that was often, catchy and really fun to listen to. You just couldn't understand the lyrics some of the time. So that book, Global Pop, set out to try to chronicle this, the rise of this genre in quotes called world music and who got put into it and who got left out or who got excluded, which was interesting because you could write the most bubblegum poppy sounding music, but if it wasn't sung in English, you'd be stuck in the world music category. So it wasn't a category that was about, African popular music or Cambodian popular music or something. It was a category where popular music got put if it wasn't being sung in English. But a lot of that music became, I mean, some of those musicians became pretty popular and pretty well known. Some of whom I wrote about in that book, like Youssou N'Dour, from Senegal, Angélique Kidjo, who's from Benin, now lives in Brooklyn, last I knew. So some of those musicians became pretty well known. The Grammy organization created a Grammy Award for world music. It became established as a kind of a genre, but as more of like a storehouse for non-Western music that the music industry didn't know what to do with.
Now, I think I'm right in saying that your next book is Strange Sounds, Music, Technology, and Culture. Is that right?
Yeah, well done. So that book grew out of the global pop book because I was well aware I wasn't talking about any kind of sampling, digital sampling of any world music, which was becoming increasingly common. So I got interested in questions of technology. I'm not that interested in gear, but I'm interested in, technology in culture. So that book set out to try to talk about, shifts in music and technology going back to the rise of music made with magnetic tape starting after World War II. Magnetic tape was invented by the Germans and available, worldwide after that. That's probably my least known book, though I'm still proud of it. My first ethnography is in that book. I did an ethnography of psychedelic trance scene in New York City in the very late 90s. Because psychedelic trance music sampled, Indian music and used all kinds of different cultures' iconography, like Pacific Northwest Native Americans and Indian iconography, and like you name it. I mean, you would see this in parties, as they call them. They didn't call them raves. And so, yeah, I'm still proud of that book, but it's probably my least known book.
And tell us about that movement into ethnography. What that was driven by, what it's brought you, because it's been an important feature of your work since.
Well, I was trained as a historical musicologist, which in my day was strictly classical music and jazz, and that was it. I started graduate school in the late 80s or mid 80s even, finished in the early 90s, and you could not work on popular music if you were in musicology in that era. You couldn't even work on reasonably recent classical music. I remember one of my professors saying that, music written in the last few decades didn't have enough history, quote unquote,
Excuse me.
but this is the beginning of the cultural studies boom, or at least, the beginning as I knew it, being relatively isolated. And, people were talking about contemporary cultural production all the time. And so I think that was the very beginning. But then I met somebody whom I would later marry, who's an anthropologist, Sherry Ortner, for the listeners. And of course, she's an anthropologist. And the people I was hanging out with the most in grad school were ethnomusicologists, for whom ethnography is the main methodology also. And I thought the ethnomusicologists were just more interesting, and I was writing a dissertation about very recent contemporary, mostly classical music, but there was a couple chapters on popular music, which became part of global pop. But I could talk to my musicians, they could talk to their musicians. And that was very unusual in musicology. I mean, nobody was writing dissertations in musicology on post-World War II music. The only person I can think of who was my colleague here at UCLA, Bob Fink, who wrote his dissertation about minimalism. So it was very unusual, and it was a long, well, Sherry once joked that about a, I can't remember who she said this, but a colleague of hers said that being married to somebody else is like being in a perpetual postdoc. I mean, somebody in a different field. I mean, so I've sort of picked up a lot of vicarious knowledge about anthropology over the years. But also, I'm not ashamed to admit that I, one summer, I don't know what, 20 years ago, I took Sherry's class, or sort of overview of anthropological theory class, over the whole summer. I worked through her syllabus. We met once a week, and I read Marx and Weber and Durkheim and who else? Anthony Giddens, Bourdieu, and I'd read a lot of this stuff on my own. But it was like when I lived in New York, and I would know parts of New York popping up in the subway, but I didn't really have a feeling for the whole city. I didn't have a map of the whole city in my head. I just knew these islands. So taking that class was giving me that map. so that I could really see, like how much Weber owes, Bourdieu owes to Weber or whatever. And that made a huge difference. That doesn't answer the question about ethnography, but I think it. I probably already always thought this, but I have come to think strongly that theory needs an object, whether it needs historical data or ethnographic data or something. And what Bourdieu calls what is it? Theoretical theory, theoreticist theory, I think he said. That doesn't interest me. I think you need to identify problems that you've seen in the real world, either historically or ethnographically, and then you say, okay, how do I try to figure out what's going on? And then the theory is one of your tools to do that. But I'm not interested in just reading somebody's theory that doesn't have to do with anything that I can know about in the real world.
And a while later, I'm not sure if this is the right chronology, out comes Beyond Exoticism, Western Music and the World, which is in a sense the recto verso of the global slash world pop. And much of your work is very political in ways that I find incredibly valuable, because what I need in life is people who can do the technical musical stuff and explain it to me in terms I can understand, and the politics. And you blend them wonderfully, as does Ana Maria Ochoa or some other authors that we could name. In that book, as I say, it's like a recto verso of the first one you'd done 10 years earlier. And here you're grasping the nettle of classical music, or I guess it now is supposed to be called written music, isn't it? Or noted music. Tell us about the argument of that book and the connection between the so-called classical and the colonial.
Well, part of it grew out of the frustration with musicology for being ahistorical. It can be very frustrating. You could talk to somebody who works on, late 18th century music, and they really know late 18th century European history. But that's in a separate box in their minds than the music. The music itself, it's withstood the, whether it's, Mozart or whatever, it's withstood the test of time, and all this historical data doesn't matter. It's like, of course it matters. We need to put these things together. They're not in two separate boxes. So the Beyond Exoticism book is a way to try to move beyond the musicological characterization of, Western fascination with the other, quote unquote, musically, and to say, well, wait a minute, the people in the West viewed their others in different ways in different historical moments, and we can see that musically, and we need to stop using the term exoticism to describe every kind of West non-West encounter and talk about that encounter in specific historical terms. That's the overall thrust of it. But it was also there's some arguments in there that I think were also meant to grapple with sort of classic musicological approaches. And the one that I'm proudest of in that book, which hasn't gotten a lot of traction, I think, but I mean, so often what musicologists talk about is in technical terms, like this instrument derived from that previous instrument, and that previous instrument derived from that previous instrument. And it's, for me, that's not a very interesting way to do history. I'm much more Foucaultian. How is today different than yesterday? Those kinds of questions. So whether you call it genealogical or archaeological, but so what I'm proudest of, I think, in that book is a chapter. It's probably too big. Probably should have been two chapters, but a chapter that deals with the rise of tonality and the rise of operas as a genre in Western Europe in the 17th century. So tonality is the do re mi system that we're all familiar with because it's the dominant musical language by far. And if you read the standard musicological histories of tonality, it's all technical. And it's like, well, wait a minute, especially because there was before tonality, there was a system of modes. I won't get technical, but one of those modes is called, well, I can give an example, like the Parsley, Sage, Rosemary, and Thyme song, that famous song. That's in an ancient Greek mode called Dorian mode. So there's a bunch of these old modes. One of them is called Ionian, which is the same as the do re mi scale. So you have this system of modes in which what we now call the major and minor, the major scale, one of those modes existed for centuries. So the question is, why did this get promoted as the dominant musical language when it did? And my answer to that was because of European colonialism, because the way we talk about tonality is always in terms of space. We talk about the composer traverses different tonal regions, or the composer moves from this key to that key, but it's always about space and movement, which to me was super interesting. The tonality gives you a way to construct sort of homes and aways, or selves and others, that these other musical systems didn't do, or at least didn't do as well. And to me, right or wrong, at least it's a cultural and historical explanation for the rise of that musical system, and it's not simply a technical one. And it seems to me, I can't speak about the field of history, but it seems to me, at least in music history, we too often fail to ask questions about why did this thing happen, when it did, and where it did, instead of some other time and place. That question just doesn't get asked, which in a way is good. It means a lot of work remains to be done. I don't work so much on, actually, I don't really work on Western European classical music at all anymore, but I still do historical research, so that's still a relevant question for me.
Well, there's a shift into the commodification of musical forms in your book, The Sounds of Capitalism, which I find that I have in both English and Spanish. And this is about the way in which music and advertising commingle. And your subtitle includes the provocation that this is part of what you call the conquest of culture. Could you share with the group, as we say in therapy?
Well, I hope it's therapeutic for all concerned.
What's by that, Prof?
Well, let me do a quick backstory. I think it's revealing about the discipline, and or maybe more than just musicology. But I got interested in the subject of advertising music because right after I finished my global pop book, which came out in '97, I noticed there's a lot of fake world music being used in TV commercials. It's fake, meaning you could hear like quote unquote ethnic percussion or something like that, but it wasn't actual music, from a real culture somewhere. It was just made up by people in a studio. So I got interested in, because I heard it in a number of TV commercials. So I thought I'd write an article about it, and I managed to track down some of these composers to talk to them. And all of them were really happy to talk. And then I realized nobody had ever taken them seriously before. Musicians don't take advertising music very seriously, and scholars had never looked at them really. Then I thought, well, I guess I have a book here. And it took a long time because I had to do a lot of archival research, and I interviewed a lot of people. Not to answer your question, so in interviewing all these people and then reading, especially, not especially, but notably Thomas Frank's book, The Conquest of Cool, which is about how the advertising industry sort of, attempted to sort of co-opt the counterculture in the 60s. And people I interviewed who were around in the 60s talked about that. But what struck me is that I can go further back. So, Michael Schuetz in 84 wrote a book called Advertising the Uneasy Persuasion, and he talks about, or he wonders if there's a thing called capitalist realism, like in the Soviet Union, there was socialist realism. And so he wonders, is advertising, a kind of capitalist realism, which I think you could hear in music, advertising music, from most of its existence. There was something that people refer to as the Madison Avenue Choir, like you hear a big chorus singing about the properties of, Budweiser beer or whatever. And this became a cliche, but it became a sound that you would not m mistake for any other sound. You would hear advertising music and you wouldn't say, oh, that's a popular song. Once in a while, an advertising song would be popularized as a pop song, but mostly not. But then, especially starting in the 21st century, it's advertising music gets closer and closer and closer to sounding like popular music, to the extent that it became harder and harder to tell the difference between, a real pop song and an advertising song. And one of the people I interviewed for that article, which came out in 99, I think. So I was interviewing him about some commercials he had done, and he said, "Oh, well, yeah, but that's music made to order. I have a band, and that, that's my creative outlet." I'm sort of paraphrasing. And so I continued the interview, and he talked about music he wrote for a particular commercial. And I said, "Oh, could you send me a cassette of that too?" Because he's already going to send me stuff, cassettes. That dates the conversation. And he said, "Oh no, I don't need to send you a cassette. It's on my band's album." So he made this distinction between like music made to order and advertising music, but in fact, that distinction didn't exist so much. And some of these musicians will take advertising music and modify it for their own use. They can't use it exactly because it's owned by the brand. The brand is paying the ad agency, which pays the musicians. And so that's why I talk about the conquest of culture, the advertising music sounding more and more like music, but also brands talking about how they want to be, they don't just want to be recognized as brands. That there's a quote I use in teaching, and I think it's in the book too, where some executive of Burger King says, "Everybody knows Burger King, the brand. Our job isn't to sell Burger King. Our job is to make Burger King the kind of brand that people want to put on a t-shirt." Which to me is a striking quote. That's almost verbatim. So there's this desire on brands to try to sort of infiltrate people's lives and consciousnesses that is fairly new. I mean, the way we talk about branding today only goes back to the 60s. I mean, people were promoting themselves beforehand, but in terms of how advertising agencies think and work, that branding as we now think of it only goes back to the 60s. So it's a fairly recent thing. But it was difficult to be totally critical of the people I interviewed because, they're struggling to make a living, So who am I as a tenured professor to say you shouldn't do advertising music,
Well, one of the points you make in the book, Prof, is that anecdotes and small stories about life under capitalism are valuable, but they need to be placed in a wider history in order for them to resonate. And I think that's one of the achievements of the book. I think it's also an achievement in a different way in your co-edited volume that provides originary voices about the advent of phonography, sound in cinema, technology in general in the sphere of culture, the Music, Sound and Technology in America book. And one of the things that's really lacking in the history of technology is this kind of archival depth and selection that you guys provide in that book. And I wonder if you could tell us what you were seeking to get at. Also has a kick-ass cover. Really
Yeah, I love
fantastic.
the cover. Yeah, well, that book, I mean, that's a product or a byproduct of the music and advertising book. I was looking for, well, I still remember fondly, Columbia University had, where I used to teach, had all these old radio magazines in a library annex, up in Harlem. So I walk up there and I spend like the entire day going through these old radio magazines. There's all this stuff about music on the radio that I'd never heard of or seen. And I realized we don't know anything about the history of music on the radio. And I don't mean like the presentation of operas on the radio. I mean, this music on the radio. There's not, nothing was known. So even though I was writing a book about music and advertising, I started collecting all this stuff about music on the radio. And then I had the idea for a reader, but I figured nobody'd be interested in a reader about music on the radio, and then I should get somebody to work on phonograph and film too. But it became really important to me to try to put those primary sources under people's noses, because there's so much talk about how, the phonograph was invented and it changed everything. Like, well, did it? Like, what exactly happened? And a lot of this just wasn't known, especially radio. And that made the advertising book pretty hard to write in a way, because the main texts about the history of advertising in America were based on print advertising. So T.J. Jackson Lear's book, and
Fantastic, yeah.
so not about broadcast advertising, which is a lot harder to write about, because maybe you can't get your hands on the old radio show, or you can't view the old TV show. And so I really wanted to put that stuff out there under people's noses, which is one of my ways of trying to get musicologists to be more historical. But also, I have to say, this is probably less interesting, but there was a thing that started in the late 80s, early 90s that people called the new musicology, which I was part of for at least a short time, because for a short time it was trying to be more ethnographic and more cultural and more ethnomusicological. But it quickly became more sort of textual and sort of comp litty, which is fine with me, but in some ways, but especially if it means greater theoretical sophistication. But what happened was that people were spending even less time with primary sources. And there's more and more, this is what I think about this song, or this is what I think about this music video, which honestly doesn't interest me that much. What interests me is, I spent a year doing this ethnography, and let me tell you about it. Or I spent a year in the archives. I mean, I can listen to the music video or watch the music video and come up with my own ideas about it, but I can't replicate somebody's, empirical research that they took a year or two to do. So musicology went more and more in this direction, in this, sort of textual interpretation sort of direction. Whereas when I was trained, it was a historical field. So I really want to put those sources, as I keep saying, I want to put those sources under people's noses, and remind people that, there's a history out there that we're lacking, and we can't do this thing, which you see in a lot of writing, which drives me nuts, where people will say, oh, when audiences heard this, they thought that. Well, how do you know? It's like, I want the historical data. Plus, it was just fun, going through all those old magazines, and I mean, it's the closest one can come to time travel, is looking at those old things and going into archives.
You then confront capitalism and music head on when you seek to become the fourth voice after Marx, Weber, and Adorno in music and capitalism about their mutual imbrication. And one of the most interesting parts of that book is when you write about Angélique Kidjo. And I wonder if you could situate the volume in that context.
Well, Angelique is somebody I wrote about. I really tried hard to interview her, but I just couldn't get beyond her manager. She's somebody I talked about in Global Pop. And she's really emblematic of the kind of moves, or position takings, if I want to be Bourdieusian, that a world music musician has to make. So, for example, she used to sing some songs in her native language, Fon, and she sang some songs in French. But at a certain point, she started singing in English. Just to try to cultivate a broader audience. So, a lot of world music musicians have had to do that. But there's also questions, which I wrote about, I can't remember where, maybe it was in Beyond Exoticism, but in the early days of world music, there's a lot of discussions about authenticity. People want like the authentic Mbalax music from Senegal or whatever. But people quickly got tired of the authentic, because it didn't sound approachable enough. It wasn't enough like our music. And so people thought it was, too strange. And so authenticity gets dropped in favor of the authentic hybrid. So, somebody, a musician like Angelique Kidjo, who can make music that sounds a little different, but not so different that it's unfamiliar. And she's very good at that. She's not the only world music musician who is, but She's very good at that, you know, and she's been good at sort of I don't want to say rebranding, but you know, repositioning herself for this changing market, which I'm sure will change again. I'm less plugged in right now about what's going on in the world music scene. I was plugged in for a long time, but I've been, as we discussed, I've been working on other stuff in recent years.
And you then produce a collection of your papers, Music in the World, really interesting individual essays. I wonder if you could talk us through, if you can remember it, one in particular that I like, because it's always fascinated me, which is the role of classical music in US commercial radio in the 40s, when the NBC orchestra was a big thing, for example. Could you explain a bit about that to us before Top 40?
Well, in the early days of broadcasting, there's a lot of concern about commercials. You know, Herbert Hoover, who was the chair of, what was he, the Commerce Department, you know, famously talked about that the radio airways shouldn't be drowned in advertising chatter. So audiences were treated with a great deal of trepidation. And networks wanted to try to make themselves sort of, you know, give themselves cultural capital and prestige. And so they would spend money on what were known as sustaining programs, in that they were sustained, the costs were sustained by the network itself. And these were high prestige programs like the NBC Symphony or the NBC Music Appreciation Hour, which started airing in the 20s, and it was meant for school kids to listen to. You know, like during school hours, they would, you know, put down their notebooks or whatever and listen to classical music, and Walter Damrosch talking about it. And this brought a lot of prestige to the networks, especially CBS, but NBC, but not only NBC. And this lasted even beyond the Depression. I mean, harder sell tactics came in with commercials after the Depression, but you know, the NBC Symphony lasted into the 50s. So there was a, you know, a lot of desire to try to not just refrain from offending the radio audience, but trying to, you know, democratize, quote unquote, access to, quote unquote, great music, or lift up the taste of the nation through this kind of music, which I think that rhetoric is pretty much, I wouldn't say it's pretty, I was about to say it's pretty much gone. It's not gone, but it's nowhere near as powerful as it used to be. And you can see that in just, you know, who gets hired to conduct orchestras now. I mean, somebody like Gustavo Dudamel here in Los Angeles, I mean, he's really good, but he was hired in his 20s. And, you know, 30, 40 years ago, a conductor for a major American orchestra would have been told, oh, you're very good, but, you know, go get a gig in a regional orchestra and we'll see you in 20, 30 years. But it's, you know, classical music has tried to attract, you know, more young people, and it's trying to be hipper and cooler, and it's changed a lot. It's, I think it worries less about the prestige issue and just w worries about its own survival and attracting younger audiences.
And Prof, I've got two more questions for you, if I may, before throwing it to you to add anything you may wish for as we conclude. The first question of my last two is about the Working Musicians book. Came out last year, 2023, and you're looking at the people who provide the music that we may notice very dramatically, a James Bond film, a John Williams score, John Barry, plus material that may be so much in the background, but crucial to our understanding of diegesis, that we barely notice it as ordinary listeners. And you point out in the book, this is remains in the Hollywood idiom, very male-dominated, sometimes genealogically contoured in terms of family connections. And it's not only films, as you say, it's also video games and television and so on. This is a wonderful book based on lots and lots of research of different kinds. I'm wondering if you could tell us what you found out that surprised you.
I think what surprised me the most was just how concerned these musicians have to be with making a living. I thought I was going to write a book about creativity, and there's a chapter about creativity.
There is, yeah.
But what these guys wanted to talk about was getting gigs and getting paid. Those two things mattered the most. And this, I mostly did not interview famous musicians. I interviewed a few that I could get to. Just I was curious, is their life different than it is for these less famous musicians? And it wasn't much different. I mean, they would get paid more money, but a lot of it comes down to the bosses, I mean, if they have a director who leaves them alone to do their own thing, you could get paid, $5,000 with a director like that, or you could be Don Williams with a director like that. It doesn't matter. I mean, from their perspective. So, but that really struck me, just how much they're concerned with getting a gig and getting paid and getting along.
Yeah.
And
Got a
thank you
great
for your.
quotation at the beginning from Randy Newman, I think.
Yes.
He says, if the director tells you to put a kazoo in, you do. And that's Randy Newman, an immensely famous musician and son of a member of Hollywood compository royalty, right?
Yeah, that was striking.
It's wonderful.
Yeah, I think that book really, not that you asked me about it, but I would say that book follows on the advertising book. I just got interested in these hidden musicians. Ruth Finnegan in the UK wrote a terrific book called Hidden Musicians, so I couldn't use that title. But I just got interested in, these everyday musicians whom, unless you're Mike Post in TV or, John Williams in film, like most of these musicians are never known about, but they're, if they're lucky, they're working every day. The hard part, which you would appreciate, and your listeners too, the hard part about that book was really theorizing it, because I felt sort of trapped by all this British cultural industry stuff, much of which is very good, but it wasn't very cultural for my, sort of anthropologized perspective. And I really wanted to try to figure out a way to talk about these musicians as part of a culture, and how they work with others. And that was hard. It was hard to try to get out from under all the British cultural industry stuff, which, as I say, a lot of it is very good and I like, but it's different. British social anthropology is different than American cultural anthropology, and I wanted to be more cultural. So that was the sort of the theoretical problem that I dealt with in that book.
Yes, well, I think part of the issue is that British academia on culture is utilitarian to the max.
Yeah.
And ironically, US academic life still somewhat less so. Last question, Prof, is about you as a musician.
Okay.
Share it with the group. We're back in group therapy, and you say, my name is Tim, and I'm a musician.
Well, my mother, God rest her soul, recalls that when I was little, they gave me one of those little toy xylophones, and I used to pick out tunes on it. I wouldn't just bang it. And then we had a bedspread with like ridges on it, and I would like play the ridges like piano keys. And my mother's mother was a musician, so at some point I started getting piano lessons, only on visits, because my grandparents lived in Connecticut when I was really little, and I grew up in Michigan. And then I guess I got piano lessons first, and then in my school band I got a clarinet, and clarinet became my main instrument. And I went to the National Music Camp in Interlochen, Michigan in 1978, and I decided I didn't want to try to be a musician. I didn't quite rise to the top of the heap. So I went to a small private liberal arts college, Middlebury College, where there wasn't much of a music program, but I missed it, and I added music as a double major. I majored in something called Northern Studies, like, environmental studies in the North. My parents are botanists, so that was that influence. But I added music as a major, and then I applied for music school afterwards. There's a degree called an MM, a Master of Music. So I applied only to two places, the Yale School of Music and Northwestern University. And I got, by some miracle, I got into the Yale School of Music, which is a very small program. They only take two wind players per year, and two instruments, sorry, two persons per instrument per year. And I loved it, but I realized I wasn't going to make a living as a philharmonic player. And I kept it up. I kept playing. And then in the late 80s, the University of Michigan used to have this exchange and fellowship deal with Queen's University of Belfast, which I won and went on. I spent a year, 88, 89, in Belfast. And one night I walked into a pub and I saw people playing tunes and sitting around and drinking beer and having fun. And as somebody who had only ever been a classical musician, I was astonished. I'd never seen people like having that much fun playing music, because music was serious. And I mean, sometimes it was enjoyable, but it was mostly serious and competitive. And so I learned to play the tin whistle, which had the same fingerings as the upper register of the clarinet, and it took a longer time to learn the style. I came back to Ann Arbor, started a session at a local Irish bar with an undergraduate fiddle player. Session is still going at Conor O'Neill's bar, so I'll give it a plug. And about 20 years ago, I started the wooden flute, which I still play. I play in an Irish bar in Long Beach every Sunday. There's no Irish bar with music in LA right now, so we all got to go to Long Beach, which is not too far. But I love it. Well, there's an article, there's a in the in my forthcoming book, about music and value, anthropological value theory. There's an article or a chapter in there about the Irish traditional music session as being about sort of a musicalized sociality. But it's generally the highlight of my week.
Now, my recollection, Prof, is that when I lived in LA, I went and heard you play, and there was a bar, an Irish
Ah,
bar
yeah.
that had music
Santa Monica.
in Santa Monica.
Yeah, well.
I think you invited me along. I think I was there on my own. It was a wonderful evening.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, well, that bar, unfortunately, when the economy tanked in 2008 with the Great Recession, they stopped having us in. They were very generous. They would give us, what was it, free drinks and half price on food, and people would get paid to host the session, as we say. So they thought that that was too much money. But the bar in Long Beach was going then, and it's still going. And the owner is Irish, so we hope, nothing will change.
Wonderful. Well, on that note, I'd like to throw it back to you if I could, Prof. T, lest there be things that you would like to add to what we've discussed.
Well, I think I've got all the things I might say on my hobby horse, I have said. I think, for at least for younger folks listening, I would say that empirical research of whatever sort matters a lot, and you can't really have a politics unless you do it.
I quite agree. However, I would add that you are always writing in a theoretically informed way, and it's that blend that is so distinctive in your output.
Well, thanks.
So, thank you very much, Prof. Tim.
Thank you, Toby. It's been a pleasure.